Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information on this, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells.
In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Arcana Castellino. Will be telling us a little bit about dystonia. So tell me a little bit about your experiences with dystonia.
Well, I have been working with the foundation for 3 years, and although I personally do not have dystonia, I have encountered, met, spoken with a number of dystonia patients, and they can have anywhere from a twist in the neck to a full body twisting and trembling, like a dystonic storm, and it can happen at different parts in their bodies. The dystonia is a neurological movement disorder and can cause muscle contractions either in certain parts of their body or their entire body.
So, do you know offhand about how many people are affected by this condition?
Yes, we do not have exact numbers, but it is estimated an approximate 50,000 people in Canada have dystonia.
So,
and it is the most common movement disorder.
So, can you give me an overview of some of the work of the foundation?
Sure. Our foundation has, I would say, four goals. One is to fund research. There is no cure for dystonia, so we're always funding research for treatments, cure, diagnosis, anything that would help dystonia patients. Then it would be awareness. There is a lack of awareness in the medical community, in general public, so we work our best to create awareness through various resources like our website, social media, in person. Then we also provide patient support. You can imagine most people with dystonia, they have never heard of it when they're first diagnosed, so they need somewhere to go to, and we have a large support group network across Canada. And fourth, we advocate for dystonia patients, especially when they're denied support, resources due to lack of knowledge of the condition.
So when you mention advocacy, are there any myths or misperceptions about dystonia out there?
Yes, there certainly are. One big challenge that patients face is because of the disability, sometimes they're perceived as less intelligent, which may not be the case. They're often in pain or in need of assistance. And sometimes it's not very visible to anyone, so people don't know that this person is suffering with a disorder. And they wonder, like, oh, this person is perfectly fine. So there are certain social stigmas attached to dystonia.
So how do you go about challenging these myths and misperceptions?
So awareness is key here. Now, September is Dystonia Awareness Month, and not just in September, but all through the year, we're constantly providing the dystonia community with tools and resources for educating everybody about dystonia. And even within the patient community, sometimes patients may lack the information about the condition. So we're constantly conducting webinars for patients. Then we have videos that we've created about dystonia that's available for the dystonia community to share. Then we also have merchandise that that people can use wear. For example, we just have we newly got our dystonia face masks considering COVID. So various tools like that.
So in your time with the foundation, has there been any success story that stands out for you?
Yes, for sure. We have definitely increased awareness of dystonia. I would say we've had a lot of people access the resources we have provided over these years. We have funded a lot of research. Just last year alone, we funded about four research projects. One is a clinical fellowship to a research project based on treatment, and one was an early investigator. We're always encouraging more medical professionals to take on dystonia as the topic of research. That's pretty much it.
So, are there any projects on the horizon for the foundation?
Oh, certainly, yes. We have a new podcast series that we're about to launch starting November. We have a couple of webinars where we connect patients with the treaters to sort of educate them and also provide them a platform to have their questions answered. As most patients may have felt this, that there's very limited time when they're at their appointments and they're not able to get every answer. So we are definitely looking forward to providing more platforms like these for patients to help improve their life.
So if you could send any message to the community about this condition and the need for the work to keep pressing forward, what would you say?
I would certainly say please do visit our website, that's www.dystoniacanada.org, and check out the work we do. Read a little bit about dystonia. There's a page where you can read some quick facts about dystonia. Learn a little more. That certainly helps patients and everybody in general.
So, can you tell me a little bit about how a patient might be diagnosed or start to recognize they have this condition?
Oh, the process for diagnosis can be arduous. It's so patients say it takes about 1 year to sometimes 10 years. And recently we met someone who took 20 years to receive her diagnosis. So it can be long. First step is they definitely have to check with their family physician who would refer them to a neurologist who then provides them a diagnosis. But getting an appointment can take very long, and often patients are misdiagnosed, which is why they go about 10 to 20 years sometimes without a diagnosis.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Thank you so much, Cam.
Of course.
In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Peter Lawson, who will be telling us a little bit about adaptive snow sports. So tell me a little bit about your experiences with adapted snow sports.
I have been with the Silver Star Adaptive Snow Sport system for 19 seasons. And beyond that as well within the BC Adaptive and the Canadian Adaptive systems, as well as a teacher and an instructor and a course conductor. So I help develop instructors.
So can you tell me a little bit about what sports are available in terms of adaptations for snow?
Well, both skiing and snowboarding are covered by the adaptive snow sport. And we are predominantly, and Silver Star Adaptive and the Canadian Adaptive system is more exclusively towards downhill than the cross country. that's about would more be covered by Nordic Canada, the cross-country side of things. Within that, then, I guess you're looking for the, you know, the different, we call them maybe disciplines within the downhill snowboard and skiing adaptive.
Yes.
So then kind of break it into two components, being both a physical disability and the cognitive disabilities. Physical disabilities, you know, run from spinal injuries, leg injuries, other means and reasons, and then a cognitive autism and other cognitive impairments. And that that element is kind of increased substantially in the last handful of years within our program and across the country.
So can you tell me a little bit about some of the adaptations you might make for someone with something like autism?
Again, autism is a huge variant within the persons within autism. Some may require some physical adaptations, maybe support physically, upright, maybe some form of, we call it a snow slider, something they stand on as skis. Some may require tethers and harnesses to help kind of control their speed and their direction and where they want to go and where we want them to go. And beyond that, it's more understanding, or trying to understand how they think and how they see the world is the greater challenge within autism and cognitive challenges.
So, to look at the other side of things, what sort of physical adaptations are most common?
Certainly the, I guess the sit ski have become kind of the flash of the industry in the last 10 years or so. So those have been greatly engineered over those many years. So you've got, the single ski, the mono ski, which you'll see kind of probably predominantly in the world of race or high-end skiing. And, those allow the persons with back breaks, say quadriplegics, paraplegics, and other forms of disabilities that require them to be seated. And then from there we get into other forms of people with the ability to stand one-legged or on both legs. They would use outriggers to help maintain balance. And outriggers, I guess, for a visual image, would be crutches with little skis on the end of them. So they're standing upright, and they use those to help create direction change and maintain balance. For persons who need a little more support, yes, there is a rigs called snow sliders, other things which are themselves have skis and kind of a fully brace, and they can lean their body weight on them, and that can help get them around. And then even within some forms of physical challenges, yes, we have harnesses and tethers to help kind of keep them on track, keep them going in the right direction.
So, in your time with adapted snow sports, has there been any success story that stands out for you?
I guess we tend to tout Josh Duick, who suffered a back injury while being a coach for the freestyle program locally, and he totally took to it, of course, as being a top-end skier and athlete, and he went on to the Olympics to win a silver medal at that level. So I think that's kind of our local story.
So during this time of isolation and things being kind of hit or miss in terms of programming for a lot of organizations, how was yours adapted to the whole situation?
Well, our season certainly got cut short at the end in March as resorts started to close locally. And at this point, we haven't really, because we don't have a summer program at all, we're just kind of waiting to see what the world delivers, what the resort asks of us, and how we can work in to the resort and stay within degrees of safety and good protocol within the current new world that we find ourselves in.
So, in adapting snow sports to individuals with disabilities,
there are any major challenges that tend to present themselves?
I think each individual has their own challenges within, you know, their ability and disability. I think access around resort can be a challenge. I think this is something fairly new in terms of marketing and awareness. And, you know, when, as we do locally, we have, you know, 700 centimeters of snow a year. So that can certainly prove to be a challenge for persons to get around a resort. And certainly resorts are probably becoming aware, but it takes a long time to make changes to buildings that have been around, you know, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, as it were.
So if you could send any message about the need for this sport to continue and to grow, what would you say?
I would say that it can help change a life at particular times for particular persons when they need that kind of that boost to get out. And it certainly probably has changed some families' lives where, you know, they can come out and ski together and share that joy. So that's, of all, you know, as you asked the previous question about, you know, what are some of the key moments, there's probably more than one of those where you see a family light up because they're able to ski together or snowboard together. And that's important.
I'd like to thank you for taking time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Keep yourself safe and protected from COVID-19. The best way to prevent illness is to avoid being exposed to the virus, so here are a few easy tips. Wash your hands often with soap and water or an alcohol-based hand sanitizer. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth with unwashed hands. Avoid close contact with people who are ill. Self-isolate and stay home when you are ill. Practice physical distancing by staying 2 meters away from the nearest person. Clean and disinfect objects and surfaces that are frequently touched. And avoid sharing personal household items like cups and towels. CJMFM wishes everyone a happy and healthy summer.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information on this, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Arcana Castellino about dystonia, and from Peter Lawson about adaptive snow sports.
In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Renee King from All Things Kabuki. So tell me a little bit about All Things Kabuki.
So All Things Kabuki is a U.S. patient advocacy group. We're a nonprofit. We're actually the only U.S. patient advocacy group supporting Kabuki syndrome. However, we do support Kabuki syndrome globally. And we actually started the organization in 2013, but we did not incorporate until 2015.
So, for those who might not be as familiar, can you tell me a little bit about how Kabuki syndrome affects a person?
So Kabuki syndrome, it's a genetic disorder, and there's two known genes that are the cause. They believe that there may be additional genes that cause the disorder, but we have found that it affects each individual differently. So one patient may have congenital heart defects where another doesn't, or if one patient has, say, hypoplastic left heart syndrome, another might have an aortic insufficiency. So each patient could have completely different underlying complications or varying intellectual delays. So it's quite complicated, and I think that that is part of the difficult part in finding a treatment and why there's no cure is there's no two kids that are the same at this point. So it makes it hard for our researchers.
So can you tell me a little bit about the advocacy work itself? How you go about advocating for patients with this?
We started with just trying to put resources in the hands of parents originally. Part of how we morphed into a patient advocacy group was parents were on the Facebook groups asking each other, how do you explain Kabuki syndrome to people when they ask you? You can't go into this long dialogue about what's wrong, say, with your child. So we ended up just making these little business card, little business card on with a brief description of what the disorder is, and put those in the hands of parents. And then as we kind of rolled into what just started as helping parents, ended up being a nonprofit. And then we have brochures now, and we try to put out other resources, welcome packets and frequently asked questions, different types of resources that we can give to parents. And then we started hosting conferences, and we have a website now. And so, the biggest portion of our advocacy is helping parents, putting tools in parents' hands. But then another portion of that is educating clinicians and even geneticists. And so we have a medical outreach that we do every year, except this year, just because everybody's a little bit tied up with COVID-19. But we have a have you seen a patient with Kabuki syndrome, a medical or a clinical flyer is what we call it. And we send that out to, we try to target 500 doctors or clinics and geneticists every year, and it gives them some information about Kabuki syndrome. It has 6 photos of different ages of patients and a list of experienced geneticists in every region of the United States, so that if a doctor comes across an individual that they think might have the disorder, it gives them somebody to contact. So we've kind of expanded our advocacy into the medical field at this point, too, to help speed up the diagnostic, odyssey for patients now, too.
So, do you know offhand about how many people are affected by the syndrome?
We don't. Our medical advisors think we're closer to maybe 1 in 15,000 globally. Right now the number is listed as 1 in 32,000, but we don't really have a way, because of HIPAA and privacy policies like in the United States, to get a more accurate number. So they think, based on advocacy efforts and doctors getting a better understanding and the frequency of diagnosing patients, that we're probably, our numbers are probably higher than that now. But we don't have an actual number at this point.
So in your time with all things Kabuki, has there been any success story that stands out for you?
I think the one story that has stuck with me is we have one family that was doing a fundraiser in their state. It was in the lower 48, and it wasn't necessarily affiliated with us, but they were doing a local fundraiser, and I believe it was in Missouri, and a mother saw of the poster, and it was a picture. There was a picture of the family's daughter on it, and she had said that her, I believe her daughter was, the mom that saw the poster, I believe her daughter was 30. And she says, wow, that looks like my daughter when she was a baby. And they actually didn't have a diagnosis for her daughter. And she had connected with the family that was hosting the fundraiser. She ended up contacting us, and we connected her. I sent her daughter's baby picture to one of our medical advisors, and they ran it through a program called Face to Gene. And Kabuki syndrome was one of the disorders that popped up as a top three. And so mom pursued genetic testing for Kabuki syndrome, and her daughter at the age of 30 got a genetic diagnosis. So it took them 30 years to have a name, but because this one family did a fundraiser in their state, and mom saw a picture that looked like her daughter as a baby, 30 years later they got a diagnosis. So that was really cool. I'll probably never forget that.
Right, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
My friends, I was recently reminded by someone that in disability life, owning your own condition, taking hold of the knowledge of what it is and what it means, is an absolute must. Many cases, with a rare condition, a patient will end up explaining to a doctor what it is and what it means. For a doctor who might have heard about this once in medical school in passing, they're not going to deal with it on a day-to-day basis. For someone who lives it each and every day of their life, it's not a pair of shoes they slip off at night. It's a part of who and what they are. And so, it's advocacy groups, concerned citizens, and the patients themselves who are the strongest voice when it comes to getting the word out about rare conditions. Yeah, in many cases, they can bear a resemblance to the more household name conditions. For the smaller groups, it's about partnerships, it's about getting the word out, trying to make a real difference at a grassroots level, saying, this is happening to me, maybe happening to someone else, and if it is, our two voices are stronger than just mine alone. And that is also the great gift in disability life, coming together and forming that great bond. I've said it many times that when a person with a rare condition or who's never seen someone like themselves before has that first moment, that instant connection, realizing they're no longer alone, changes their lives. Because they go from that place, it's me against the world, to I'm not the only one. And I am stronger, united with someone who understands what this is and what it means. The sense of community is a great gift, my friends. It's something we all profit by. Something we've learned in these times of having to quarantine and spending more time at home, what have you. The fact is, we can carry that lesson. Communities are stronger together, going forward. No matter what the future may hold, we can remember we are a gift to one another, and if one of us stands at our best, it's easier for the rest of us too, as well. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.